Hi, I'm Bella Gandhi, founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host of this beautiful podcast. We're here to bring more love into your life, regardless of if you're single, if you're married, if you're thinking about becoming single, if you're thinking about becoming married or finding the lid to your pot. And we're going to bring more life into that love that you have or you want. You might have seen me on Good Morning America or Steve Harvey or The Today Show or 100 other places, but I'm so happy that you are here with us because we're going to make your life and your love better. Smart daters, welcome back. I'm so happy to welcome an absolutely amazing guest, Dr. Wendy Walsh. And Dr. Wendy is known as America's relationship expert. She's got a PhD in clinical psychology. She teaches in the psychology department at California State University and has been the host of the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on iHeart. Dr. Wendy, welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so happy to be here. And we're going to talk all things, ladies and gentlemen, about the science of love. So, Dr. Wendy, tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are.
I got to where I am today because of my own attachment injuries. I had everything a young woman should have to find a great mate. In my late 20s, early 30s, I was a local news anchor in Los Angeles. I was physically attractive. I was intelligent. I had a great job, but I was still dating losers over and over and over again. And it was only sort of years into it where I realized that there was a common denominator in every one of my relationships, and it was me.
You.
I was choosing them, right? For some reason, nice guys felt too nice, which is so insane. What a thought, too nice. Bad boys turned me on and I couldn't get them, quote unquote, get them to love me. And that was the roots of me starting to read originally a lot of self-help books and then eventually entering therapy. And I learned through psychoanalytic therapy how early childhood relationships really shape our model for love, and it becomes active for the rest of our life until we make conscious decisions to change it. And it's a, you know, step-by-step thing, like two steps forward, one step back sometimes. So that's how I got here.
And you said something to me, which, you know, when we were backstage, quote unquote, about how, you know, what happens to you in the formative years of 0 to 3 is what imprints. And then we tend to repeat that over and over again. So talk to us about this.
And specifically the first year of life. So think of it this way, from birth to 12 months old, the brain triples in size. It is nonverbal, so it doesn't record memories as a narrative with words. And as the brain is growing and tripling in size, it's making decisions about whether the world is safe, who can be trusted, whether people can't be trusted. And depending how your primary caregivers were able to attend to the needs of the infant is how your brain shaped this model for love. You know, the crazy thing is, if you had an early childhood that was filled with neglect or abandonment or criticism or pain or abuse, you still loved that, you know, it came at the hand of the person you love. You still had an attachment because that's your survival person. And so you grow up to think that love has to come with pain, or it has to come with some feelings of loss, or it has to come with criticism, or it has to come with abandonment
or uncertainty.
Yes. And so that's love, right? And then the other crazy thing is that once your body develops and it becomes sexual, your sexuality leads you right back to the scene of the crime to pick partners who actually will reflect what happened in your early life. I always say love isn't about pleasure and it isn't about happiness. Love is about finding the familiar. And so the idea in our adult life is to learn how to change that attachment style, learn how to find kindness familiar.
Mm. Dr. Wendy, how do we do that? So many women, especially, you know, I want a guy that's got a little bit of an edge. As soon as I hear that, I'm like, okay, you've got attachment stuff, disorganized stuff. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about this.
So I use the metaphor, you may have heard it before, of the hole in the road, the hole in the street. So there's four levels of personal growth. First level is you're walking down the street. You do not see the hole, you fall in it. Let's imagine the hole is your bad picker, your attachment disorganization, your love of bad boys. Okay. And so you don't see it. You don't understand it. You blame them. They're all bad, whatever. Stage two is you start to become aware. And this time you walk down the street and you see that hole and you recognize that hole and you still fall in because you haven't made any behavioral changes yet, right? So, but now you know, like, oh gosh, maybe I had something to do with falling in that hole because all the red flags were there, right? Stage three is at working with a therapist or a coach, you walk down that street, you see that hole, and you take very careful baby steps around that hole so you do not fall in. But stage four is you take a different street, right? And so I felt in my own life those four distinct stages, and they took years to work through. I'm actually engaged now, getting married after being a single mom for a lot of years. And the man I chose, I would have never chosen back in my player chick days, my bad boy days. He's just too sweet and kind and loving, and he's the best partner to marry.
Amazing. And so how did you get from, I mean, we work with people all day, every day on this issue where nice feels boring. Mm-hmm. And no matter what they do, and we'll say, let's go on more dates, see if it can develop. He's got all your, we call them GPQs, good partner qualities, no red flags. Let's see if the chemistry can develop. Do you have any sunlight you can shine on this issue for us? Like, what can we do if we feel like, oh my God, that's me?
So here's the thing. You have to recognize that those butterflies in your stomach that you're feeling about that guy who has an edge is actually anxiety. It's the pain that you know is coming, right? So if you can reframe your experience, remember I said your sexuality and arousal system will bring you right back to the scene of the crime. Now, what sex researchers know is that while you can't change someone's sexual orientation, you can sometimes, and when I say orientation, I don't mean based on what gender you're attracted to, it's what triggers arouse you. You can add to the menu. Right. And so like a couples therapist might say to a couple who now has a dead bed, right? They haven't been having sex for a long time. She will often say to the woman, think of sex as going to the gym. You don't want to go there. You know, it's going to hurt at the beginning. It's whatever. And then once you go and you leave the gym, it feels great. Right. So I want you to think of sex with a nice guy as that. Try it. Let your body learn that there could be pleasure in that. Turn your brain off. Literally, if there are counterintuitive messages that say, ugh, this is boring or this is not fun, literally switch your thoughts and go, wow, I can ask for my sexual needs to be met with this guy and he'll actually do it. Bad boys don't do that, right? Find a way to reframe it to the positive and then keep trying. Like, as I said, you're going to find somebody that you try and it didn't work and you slide back and then you try another and another until eventually kindness feels familiar.
Right, right. And that's where the switch happens, right? And ladies and gentlemen, as you know, I say all the time, and Dr. Wendy's saying the same thing, this takes time. It's not a 2-date, 3-date issue. This could be weeks,
even years,
and months and years of working on this. I very publicly tell people I was friends with my husband for 6 years, no thought of anything for a very long time until one day when I was available, didn't have a boyfriend and all of the things where I was like, wow, he's actually such a good, kind human being when I had dated people, let's just say, that weren't always that. And so it was really getting my own mental house in order and giving it a chance. We've now been married for over 25 years.
I should also add, congratulations, by the way, that, you know, going to individual therapy is very, very important because happiness is an inside job. Relationships do not make you happy, but happy people tend to have happy relationships. And happy people are more attractive to more people, right? So you have more partner choice.
Absolutely. And do you think going to therapy, we're talking about happiness as an inside job, that working with a therapist will help you to process and emote the things that are making you unhappy, kind of releasing it to bring you to a better place?
So absolutely, and it depends on the kind of therapist. I happen to be partial to psychoanalytic therapy because they spend a lot of time going through your childhood with a fine-tooth comb, and a lot of people don't want to do that. They want a therapist who's going to give them homework and they do something different. I'm like, no, take the time to go back and experience those feelings. And even if the memories are pre-verbal of whatever trauma or negative thing happened to you, what happens is since we have this compulsion to repeat all these other stories that you will tell your therapist about what happened in grade school, middle school, high school regarding your relationships, your therapist will be able to figure out what happened in your childhood based on that, because you're just repeating the same patterns again. When I hear people say, I have trouble with relationships because I had this really abusive boyfriend as a teenager. And I'm like, it didn't start as a teenager. You picked him as a teenager because of something that happened really early. And so spending the time to swim around your childhood and also to learn how to forgive your parents, because most parents did the best they could with the tools they had. And also learning to manage feelings. When I say happy people have happy relationships, they're not happy all the time, but when they're unhappy, when they're angry, when they're frightened, they have really good coping strategies. They know how to communicate their feelings. They know who to reach out to, who can help console them. They know how to manage their feelings well, so the feelings don't come out as, you know, erratic, strange, hurtful behavior.
You can self-regulate, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, self-regulate, but also I'm not a believer in controlling feelings or stopping feelings. And when I hear the word regulate, it sounds like we're trying to make the feelings not be there. I'm a big believer in allowing all feelings welcome. Because here's the thing, if you stay in a feeling for a while, it eventually dissipates because you're spending the time thinking about it and turning it over and processing it. And that's how you work things through. But saying, I won't show them I'm mad because I can self-regulate well, it's going to come up. And again, it's going to come back to bite you.
It's a pressure cooker. You can't keep shoving it down, right?
Right. I mean,
we're not here advocating for outward rage and, you know, having tantrums, but you also can't continue to shove things down because we're pressure cookers.
Yeah, I want to be clear. Feeling a feeling doesn't mean it has to turn into behavior.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So what happens is people take tantrums and break things and yell because they're trying to get the feeling out of their body. If you lie still or go for a walk, even better, and feel your heart racing and feel the anger and ask yourself, who hurt me? How did they hurt me? Why did they hurt me? Why am I mad? What am I mad at myself? What can I do differently next time? That's called processing anger. Right? Taking a tantrum. In fact, there's some research to show that, you know, that whole thing about scream therapy and take a pillow and hit a pillow and punch. Actually, it raises people's heart rate and blood pressure more, sometimes makes them more angry. So taking a nice walk, meditating, taking a bath, that can work better.
That's brilliant. What you're actually talking about, I think, is the definition of emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. Sitting with your feelings, feeling your feelings, and thinking about your feelings, becoming intelligent. Why am I angry? What made me angry? What triggered? What was my role in this? And sitting in it to process it on your own. I love that.
And the thing that stops many people from spending the time processing is the feeling most humans dislike more than anything is the feeling of shame. Shame is the hardest feeling to tolerate. You know, back in our anthropological past, if we were shamed by the tribe and sent out in the wilderness to die alone, this is our worst, deepest fear, right? And so we try to save face. We try to think it's not our fault, it's their fault. It's very hard to sit down and go, you know, I'm human and I forgive myself, but I made a big mistake here. And that's how you learn to tolerate shame.
You forgive yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So much of shame comes from the flagellating we do to ourselves.
Trying to save face, trying to like yourself. But you know what? You'll really learn to like yourself when you hold your psyche's hand like a small child and say, you're good enough. And I love you. And I forgive you. You're human. Nobody's perfect. If you can tell your mind that all the time, you'll have a better relationship with yourself and others, because you can say that to others too.
I love that. Let's talk a little bit about, we touched on it, kind of attachment theory and different types of attachments and how they might rear their heads in the dating world.
So there are a number of different styles of attachment. Usually somebody doesn't fit neatly into one category and that it applies to every single relationship in their life. It is possible to have different kinds of attachment to different kinds of people. But your attachment style is partly genetic. So some babies come into the world with a gene that produces more anxiety around abandonment or less need for closeness and feeling easily smothered. So there's a little genetic piece. But then those genes meet the environment, and the environment are humans and our primary caregivers. And so our attachment style grows out of the kind of relationship we had with our mother, the kind of relationship we had with our father, and the kind of relationship we witness between the two of them. Now, if one of those parents was unavailable or not there, there's already sort of a hole in the puzzle of attachment, right? We don't know how to fill it. And so as we grow up, we start to find people that will feel familiar to us and our idea. And people who lie on the anxious side tend to be the ones who count the minutes between each text, worry constantly, vigilantly watching for when they will be abandoned, because their belief system is deep down, I'm not lovable. I will be abandoned. Ironically, they tend to be most sexually attracted to those who have an avoidant attachment style. And that would be that edge that you're talking about. It creates anxiety in the anxious person because there's somebody who feels easily smothered. And so when the anxious person is clawing to meet them, where are you? Where are you going? Searching in their phone to see if they're seeing other people. They're feeling absolutely engulfed and smothered. And the way they protect themselves is they move further away. So thus the dance, right? And, you know, there's some research that was done. And by the way, you can have a totally secure attachment style too, which is wonderful. And a secure person can both give love and receive love comfortably. They also have self-esteem and a backbone that they can apologize when they're wrong. They can also show empathy and compassion when the other person is sad or mad or fearful. And so the good luck, not the good luck, the trained person who has an anxious or avoidant attachment style, who finds someone with a secure attachment style, eventually can change their attachment style because it starts to become generalized in the couple. The secure person is the model for what is healthy. But there was research on who stays together the longest, two people with the secure attachment style, or people, two anxious people, two avoidant people, or somebody with an anxious style with somebody with an avoidant style. Fascinating research. The longest relationships tend to be people who have an anxious attachment style who are with somebody with an avoidant attachment style.
They stay together the longest.
Uh-huh. They're not happy.
But they're miserable.
They're glued in their trauma. And so they're very unhappy, but they don't break up because the anxious person won't let that happen. Two anxious people, by the way, sometimes cling on and become so enmeshed that they lose an identity, an individual identity, right? And they often break up because they're trying to figure out who I am separate from that relationship. Two avoidant people can live like happy roommates in the public areas of their household, and there's, you know, no fear, no threat of intimacy. But one of them at some point might have an affair because they don't have compassion for their others, and that can cause breakups.
So interesting. You know, I say if 40 to 50% of first marriages end in divorce, right? There's another 10 to 15% of couples that permanently separate. So let's say that's 66%. Now, if that, or that takes down 2/3 of couples, if that leaves 1 out of 3 left, how many of them are actually happy? And that really, your point just resounded with me, because I tell my clients, if one out of three is left that aren't separated or divorced, how many of those do you think are happy? Even if we give them heads or tails odds, that's one in six.
Well, so, I want to clarify a little bit of statistics. You know, the media loves to throw around the 50% divorce rate, but the 50% divorce rate only applies to marriages of 20 years or longer. And this is very, very normal, because the work of the marriage is over, right? They've raised the kids and now they're doing the who am I separate from that, right? If you've been married 5 years, you have an 85% chance of staying together for life. If you've been married 10 years, you have a 65% chance. The chance goes down as you age because of our very long life expectancies. So I want to be clear that this idea of finding your soulmate in your 20s and staying together until death do you part was invented by religions, and it is not anthropologically normal in our human history. Example, if you got married in the year 1900 and professed, "We will stay together until death do us part," the average length of that marriage was 12 years.
Yeah.
If you got married in 1990, and got up on the altar and said, "Till death do us part," the average length of that marriage was 12 years. That's the average length of a human marriage. People don't talk about that. They hold as the golden ticket this great grandparents' marriage or grandparents' marriage that was 60 years long. But it is an absolute anomaly in our history. Mostly people were dying young. In 1900, average life expectancy was 38 years old, right? And so now, because of our very long life expectancies, everybody is, even the most monogamous of people, are going to see two or three long stints of monogamy with some mate selection, we call that dating, in between. And that is normal. So I really want to pull people away from this idea that, first of all, a short marriage is a failed marriage. Because the truth is, to judge a relationship based on duration is very unfair. Because if you're recovering from an attachment disorder and you realize 2 years into the marriage, oops, I did it again, I'm not going to pick like this again. Yeah. It's actually success for you to get out early.
Yes, yes, yes. Say it again for the people in the back. I love that. You're so right. And it's such a, it is exactly the right way to look at things. We weren't living until 75 and 80 years old around the year 1900 or 1600. So if you said, "I do," at the age of 16, it's like, well, we're both probably going to be dead in 10 years. So what the heck? You know, we'll have a couple, you know, dead infants in between. It's horrible, right? There was no, we didn't have adequate health care. So now we're, and we expect so much more out of marriage at this point. It's not only are we—
Well, that's the other thing, is that a marriage used to be one relationship in quite a village of relationships. We lived with multi-generational extended families. We lived in towns and villages where even cousins were around. We had all kinds of people to rely on for help with raising children or economic survival. You know, one of the reasons why arranged marriages in India have the lowest divorce rate in the world is because there are six people in the marriage. Relationships are a bridge between tribes. And so if you have the parents trying to find the best bridge for both tribes, you have a much better chance of staying together.
Oh, 100%. You know, my parents were immigrants from India. They met on a Sunday. They were engaged on Thursday. They were married 72 hours later, and they just celebrated 50. I guess this year will be 55 years for them.
Right. And I'm sure in the early years, both sets of parents were very involved. If there was a problem, they stepped in to figure out what to do.
Well, my parents have a unique story. They immigrated to the U.S. right after that. And I think that had they had that and had they been back home in Bombay, things would have been a lot easier, but they were pretty isolated here. So they've made it work. They're a good team, but it wasn't easy.
No, because they didn't have all that. I call it tribal support. You need both sets of tribes supporting the relationship. And, you know, America's focus on romantic love which is pretty new in our evolution, by the way, focus on romantic love and individual rights and freedoms doesn't bode well for marriages. You know, years ago, I used to host a show on Investigation Discovery called Happily Never After, about brides and grooms who murdered each other soon after the wedding. We had to search very hard for brides who were murderers. It was mostly the guys doing the murdering. And note to women, don't sign an insurance policy the day before your wedding. Not a good idea. Anyway, almost 100% of these marriages, they eloped. Right?
Wow.
Because had the tribe weighed in, had somebody's sister gone, I wouldn't marry that dude. I have a bad feeling about him. Right? You really do need the eyes of other people, because when you're falling in love, you know, your neurotransmitters, you have a cocktail of neurotransmitters that are making you think this person is better than they are.
Right. I tell my clients, lust is nature's way of tricking you into attachment.
Yep,
be wary.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And especially if the lust takes you back to somebody who wasn't good for you. And
exactly.
That has been, and that is your pattern. So that's super fascinating.
And I also want your people to know that for people who have attachment disorganization or disorders, sex is very important to them. It is, you know, I'm exaggerating, I'm making up this number. It's 90% of the relationship to them. They say, they use these words like, you have to have chemistry. I have to be really into them, et cetera. People who have a secure attachment style look at a partner in a holistic way. Well, how smart are they? How healthy and fit are they? What kinds of skills do they have as far as the home where we would be a good match? And oh yeah, are we gonna have sex once in a while? Yeah, that's great too. It's part of a menu of traits. But people who think the sex has to be hot or we can't be married, well, I guarantee hot sex always declines once you're into the marriage. And then they think they picked the wrong person.
Oh, brilliant. You're so right. And for those of you who are like, oh, I have to have chemistry right away. If not, I'm going to throw this person back to the pond. Listen to what Dr. Wendy just said. So it's so critical. Chemistry, I tell our clients at Smart Dating Academy, you'd uncork a good bottle of wine and let it breathe for at least 15 minutes, if not an hour, right? Let a good relationship breathe. If you have fun with somebody, if it's easy, if you find connection, but you're not feeling that physical attraction, give them a second date, a third date, a fifth date. We're trying to screen people in that are good for us versus screening them out so quickly based on chemistry.
Yes. And also, never date a person alone in isolation. In other words, yes, you meet on an app, you meet for coffee alone, etc. Very quickly get in their social ecosystem. Get to know their friends, get to know their family. See, I mean, nobody exists alone in a vacuum. So you might be thinking, oh, we're in cocooning and we're having great sex. And then when you bring your relationship into the real world, you see you're just not a match.
100%. It's like you meet your friend's boyfriend of a year, and you sit around and you're watching a playoff football game, and he doesn't utter a word to any of her friends.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very important that you, if someone doesn't let you meet their friends or family, question that.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. No, I love that. And how do you have emotional conversations, and why are those important in building great relationships?
Well, except for maybe saying every once in a while, well, how do you feel about that? Don't prod anybody else. Model it, right? Use language. So emotional intelligence is a three-pronged thing. The first is an awareness of your own feelings. A lot of people aren't even aware of their feelings. It's not their fault. Their parents didn't give them language for feelings. They would say, they would cry over something and they'd say, go to your room, come back when you have a better attitude, as the parents would say. Instead of saying, oh, I see you feel sad about something, or I see you're angry about this. Let's talk about what you're experiencing. Parents are busy or they may not have the emotional intelligence themselves to recognize the feelings and give it a word. So the first is to become aware of the entire rainbow of feelings that exist in us. Listen to your stomach. Sometimes I'll go, huh, it's bothering me. There's something going on in my stomach. Oh yeah, that thing that person said this morning, right? And then they'll give me time to process it a little bit. So becoming aware is the first thing. Second thing is finding language. You can go on the internet. There are all these vocabulary words for emotions. There's a good 36 you can learn right away. And then the third is expressing them, learning to put those words into sentences on a regular basis. So instead of saying, I'm making this up, you're always, well, we never say always in a fight with a partner, but I'll do it today. You're always late. And it makes me so crazy when you're always late for dinner. Instead of, I noticed the last few times that I cooked, you weren't able to get here on time. And it made me feel a little abandoned because I worked so hard to make the meal and I wanted to serve it hot. How could we solve this in the future? See, the person doesn't feel attacked. You said you weren't able to make it on time. What can I do differently? Here are my feelings. I felt abandoned or I felt disrespected. So what? How can we fix this? And when you use the word how in a relationship, you are now a team using your prefrontal cortex to solve a problem together instead of pointing fingers and blaming.
I love that. And it sounds very similar to one of the tools that we use in our house and what we teach at Smart Dating Academy. It's give that person the benefit of the doubt, assume positive intent, and tell them, you know what? The story I'm telling myself about you being late for dinner is it's not important to you. And I'm sure that's not your intention, but I just want to let you know when you say you're going to be home at 6 and it turns into 7:30, that's kind of how it's making me feel. And I can tell you that sentence now, when I start out with the story I'm telling myself, I watch my husband kind of put his metaphorical armor down because I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. It's like, I have a feeling, but I'm going to assume you didn't mean to give me this feeling. And immediately he's like, okay. He's like, I really appreciate you saying that first and giving me the benefit of the doubt. You're right. What I meant, you know what? It's bad of me to do that. I'm going to show up on time. And it's like, it's taken the amplitude of conflicts down 100%.
Oh, yeah. That was so well said, what you just said. I'm going to tweak it one little bit. The only word I don't like us to use in our personal relationships is making me feel, because nobody can make you feel a way you've chosen to feel that way, or your early childhood patterns made you impulsively feel that way. So just simply say, I felt abandoned, not you made me feel abandoned.
That's I lovely. Felt abandoned. I love that. You're so right, because that takes responsibility for my own feelings. I'm feeling it's not you made me feel, right? And that just further, this is a me thing. It could be a you thing. Also, you're playing into this, but ultimately it's a me thing. So I would say, is this a me problem or is this a him problem? So usually they're—
All relationships are a struggle between autonomy and unity and negotiating those boundaries every day. How am I an individual and not being lost in this relationship? And how am I a good partner in this relationship? And being a good partner sometimes means, you know, biting the bullet, compromising, because the relationship will win.
Absolutely. That's so, so correct. And, you know, what do you think that we've talked so much about, so many amazing things you've dropped, so lovely gems. If there's a thing or two that you would tell us, how do we attract? What can we do to make ourselves more attractive to a good mate?
That's easy. Love yourself. It's so simple. You know, you hear that, oh, you can't love anybody else until you love yourself. Some people say that's not true. Let's define what love is in that sense.
Yes, tell me.
If you can learn to accept yourself as how you are, to work hard to change the things that have been dysfunctional in relationships, forgive yourself for mistakes you've made in the past, then you have become lovable to others. You see, what is really attractive to everybody of all genders is somebody with self-esteem and self-confidence. Now, this is why narcissists are able to trick people, because they have false self-esteem and self-confidence, right? They're actually hiding. Their performance personality is hiding an underbelly of self-loathing. But for the rest of us, when we're actually a confident person, we can say, oh, I totally messed up. I'm so sorry. How can I make it up to you? right? And we can also say, you know, when you did that, I felt like this. So next time my boundary is going to be that. My reaction is going to be this. There is a misconception about boundaries out there that I want to clear up very well. Boundaries are not about trying to get somebody to behave differently. Boundaries are not about shaping anybody else. Boundaries are changing your reaction to them. So let's say somebody is chronically late. You've brought it up, your feelings about it. Your boundary is you just stop cooking dinner. See what happens. Till they say, I noticed you haven't been cooking. I know you weren't on time, so it wasn't worth it to me, right? So you find you change your reaction to people, and it should be a logical consequence. You don't say, he's always late for dinner, I'm going to go out and have an affair to quietly get back at him. It's got to be a logical consequence.
Right. And hopefully not just super punitive. It's like, and the punishment should fit the crime.
No. Yeah, but it's not punishment. It's you protecting yourself. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you were saying, if you're chronically late for dinner, I'm not going to go have an affair. I'm just not going to cook dinner.
Right. Or if you're chronically late, my new boundary is I won't begin cooking dinner until I see your car in the driveway. Right. Or because I like to eat earlier and you're always so late, I will eat and leave a warm plate for you. I won't wait for you. You'll figure out what it is, right? But it's all about your reaction. It's not about trying to get them to change. It's about doing what you need to do so that you feel okay.
That is such a great definition. And I think a correct interpretation of what boundaries should be. So often we're like, well, I've got to put up a boundary so that my mom doesn't blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, a boundary is for yourself and how you're going to respond to a person when they do a given behavior. That is game changing.
Yeah, like the example you just used about a mother calling too much, an adult mother calling an adult child too much is, I'm going to put up a boundary. I'm going to tell my mom not to call me anymore. That's not putting up a boundary. Putting up a boundary is not picking up the phone.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. You were amazing. Is there anything, any other, you've dropped every gem, so many amazing ones. Are there any last things you'd like to tell our smart daters?
Yes. I want women to understand that we are at a unique place in Western culture right now, where we literally have an oversupply of successful women. And women who say they can't find a great guy who will commit are holding in their brains this idea that they must date somebody who makes as much money or more than them, who has as much education or more than them, who's slightly older than them. There's been research on this. Sociologists call it the George Clooney effect. The more education and the more money a woman makes, the more she wants her mate to have even more.
Amen.
Mathematically, there's not enough to go around. And if a woman is in her childbearing years and she wants to have children, then she needs to understand that her idea of a power man might just be a guy who can power a stroller. And she's got to figure out how to be in love with kindness instead of a bank account. If that's what she wants, you can hold out and date all those playboys. You see, the men at the top, you call them alpha men, but whatever, the high men with very high mate status who are making a lot of money are not about to settle down because they don't have a fertility window. They can ride this wave of free sex for decades. And when they're 48, marry a 25-year-old.
And have kids if they want.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
And have kids at that point if they want.
Yeah, exactly. They can. So, I always say to women, you guys are good planners, right? You planned your education, you planned your retirement plan, your financial life, you've planned your wedding even, but you haven't planned your dating strategy. I am going to be married by this age so that I can have children and these are the amount of children I want to have. And believe it or not, saying that on a first date is absolutely okay. Because if he runs away, you can do the touchdown cheer. He's not for you.
Lesson release. You've dodged a bullet.
Yep, exactly.
I love that. And again, it comes down to what you so eloquently said. Be self-aware. If you know I am a badass attorney, doctor, and I want to work and I want to be a career woman, you may not need the person that's 150% of you and works harder and has more money, you might need the softer side of you, right? Yeah. There's a yin and a yang. So really getting to that self-awareness, what kind of a partner will be really good for me long-term? Not what looks good on paper, but what's going to feel good for me. And
yeah, we all need to dump the social shame thing. Who cares what people think? Just feel good yourself.
Feel good yourself. You're amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. I have goosebumps and chills at so many things that you said. So, Dr. Wendy, where can we get your books? Where can we get more of you?
Well, the main thing I do is I run a Patreon Zoom group every Wednesday night. And so you can join my Patreon group, patreon.com/Dr. Wendy Walsh. Different levels of membership. If you just want to come to the Zoom, it's 10 bucks a month. If you want to hear my podcast, is there. All my books are there. You can also not even be a member and just go on and buy books and buy podcast episodes if you want. If you want me for free, you can listen to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show live on the iHeartRadio app every Sunday night. And it's also replayed later as Dr. Wendy on Demand. So you download the iHeartRadio app, search for Dr. Wendy Walsh, and you'll hear my radio show.
We will all be listening to the Dr. Wendy radio show. That is for sure. So thank you again, smart daters.
Thank you.
I know you have enjoyed this episode, and I hope you had your notepad out to take notes. And if you like it, give us a 5-star rating. Write what you loved about Dr. Wendy. There is so much. I read every review, and it's great for us podcasters. It keeps us going. So until next week, have a beautiful week. Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.